So good afternoon, and welcome back. If this is the second time you've seen me present here, I was here earlier doing a session on gaming physics. Welcome if you haven't been before. Is my mic on? You picking me up? Okay, good stuff. Yeah. Okay, so this is going to be the second sort of in a series of two sessions. This is going to be sort of the main session I had in mind when I started preparing and working with this demo, talking about game services and telemetry processing using Microsoft Azure. The first session, the session on game physics, was kind of a spin-off of that. The history is sort of a short history. I modified a racing game to use Windows Azure. A friend of mine complained that the physics wasn't really great in the game, so I ended up spending an unhealthy amount of time rewriting the physics engine, and I just gave a session on that. What I'm going to be focusing on here is looking at how I've actually integrated this sample racing game with services that we've got in the Microsoft Azure platform. And I kind of think that although this is it's kind of a fun scenario, it's a game, it's nice to see how we can build game integration with the cloud. There's so much of the services I'm using and so much of the techniques and the technology that we've got in cloud computing that is going to be very, very relevant, not just to the gaming industry, but to a whole lot of other industries. You will have heard of the Internet of Things, and telemetry data in relation to the Internet of Things is going to be massive business. Condition monitoring, monitoring coffee machines, monitoring cars, monitoring pieces of equipment is going to be huge business. And I think, personally, that cloud computing platforms like the services available in Microsoft Azure are going to be a really big leverage in being able to make this technology happen. And I'll be talking about that as well through the session. So my name is Alan Smith. I work at a company called Active Solution in Stockholm. I spend as much time as possible doing things with Windows Azure. I'm a Windows Azure MVP, or Microsoft Azure MVP, as it's been rebranded to. And I kind of have a real passion for delivering training courses, mentoring customers, and learning about all of the new stuff that's coming out in with the Azure technologies, and being able to get that information to customers in a timely fashion so they can start adopting these technologies, providing them with advice and so on. So Microsoft is probably the biggest customer for the Azure platform. They're doing all kinds of things using Azure. Team Foundation Service runs in Azure. Office 365 is making use of a lot of the Azure services. Also, the Xbox One, Xbox One Live service is going to run on up to 300,000 servers to be able to just provide the back-end support for all of the gaming that's going on Xbox One. Now, that's not going to be a fixed figure. The cloud is built to be a scalable platform, so at certain periods there's going to be more servers, at certain periods there's going to be less services. But this is really what they're planning, with the capacity of being able to scale out to 300,000 virtual servers to actually be able to host those various services. That's kind of the maximum capacity that they're planning on. I've no idea how many servers they're actually using, but they are making extensive leverage of the Windows Azure platform. And this is both the core Xbox Live, and also games like Halo and Titanfall are making use of the Azure services within the game, not actually just running through the regular Xbox Live services. When we're talking about cloud computing, we very often talk about these kinds of usage patterns, and I've used this slide a lot. You've seen maybe various versions on this slide. I've actually taken some real-time statistics from websites to actually show the page views on sites. So something like the Olympic Games, you've got a massive view of demand on the actual website for a specific for a short period of time. We've just run the Global Windows Azure Bootcamp, and we had a website for the lab that we were running at the Global Windows Azure Bootcamp. We put that website up, and it was only running for a few weeks. We had virtually no traffic on it before the event. On the day of the event, we got almost 250,000 page views on that particular site. And we used Windows Azure websites because we knew we could launch it as a free version when we're testing, and we just scaled up the actual capacity the day before the event. And we had no problems hosting 250,000 page views on that site during the day of the event. It gave us fantastic performance. You've also got companies like Twitter, this rapid growth. And this is the gaming companies who are producing mobile games. They want a back-end service to power that mobile game. The gaming services, they've got no idea how popular their game is going to be. Is it going to be the next Flappy Bird, or is it just going to fail completely in the marketing? But, you know, it's kind of strange how social media works, and they don't know if their game is going to suddenly, you know, become really, really popular. And they, even if they know if, that it is going to become popular, they don't know when, and they don't know the usage curve. So what they want, you know, they don't have a lot of money to invest in hardware. They want to build some infrastructure that they will be able to scale, or even better, that will scale dynamically to the amount of load that they're going to be placing on it. They also need to ensure, and this is very important with cloud computing, that they can afford to pay for the capacity to actually host the game. And if you look at the amount of money that's being made off Candy Crush Saga and you know, Flappy Bird and Angry Bird and all these kinds of games that lots of people are playing, they have the business model in place to be able to handle that kind of a growth. You've also got predictable burst, Formula One. You know, some people may say the racing is predictable. I would disagree with that. But the actual you know, load curve that's going to be coming on Formula One, they can basically predict that all the way through 2014. We've got the Chinese Grand Prix. Practice is going to start tomorrow, and then they've got basically you know, the qualifying and the race. So there's going to be a load on Formula1.com, and then that load's going to go away for a couple of weeks until the next Grand Prix, and that is very, very predictable. You can basically draw this line now for the 2014 season. Very soon you'll be able to draw this for the 2015 season, pretty much where the races are going to be. And then you've got unpredictable burst. News.bbc.co.uk. There could be a catastrophic disaster taking place now that will be affecting news.bbc.co.uk. And within 5 or 10 minutes, they could get a massive demand coming in on their news website. They need to be able to support that demand. I was visiting, I can't mention any names, but I was visiting a big data center where they take on lots and lots of servers. And there's a big room full of people who are looking after all of these servers. And on the wall, they had a TV which was showing CNN with the sound turned down and with the subtitles on. And we were kind of saying, you know, what are they doing? You know, why have they got CNN? Do they watch that when they're bored? He says, no, that's really important, because if there's a major event going on in the world, that is going to affect all of the traffic that's running on servers in their data centers. So they don't want to be, you know, in this room completely blinkered, looking at the screens, wondering why everything is going crazy, if there's, you know, something going on that is going to actually be causing that. So that's why they have the TV there with CNN, because the global events will affect network traffic on their systems, and they need to understand what's happening with those global events. Now, with online games, we have something like this. This is known as Launch Week, and it's something that when they were working on the Halo 4 for the Xbox 360, they were really, really concerned about Launch Week, because they were using the Windows Azure Service Bus as the actual back end to power Halo 4. So their, you know, biggest, you know, the worst thing that can happen for a game is that you release a game and too many people buy that game. You get, you know, the game is far more popular than you anticipated, and that basically puts the services out of action. Just go on YouTube and search for what happens when a gamer can't actually access to a game service. They're kind of the most angry customers I've ever seen. They're yelling and screaming and cursing. I couldn't play any of those videos in this actual room for the actual profanity they use, just because the gaming service is down. But it is really bad press, bad news. They're going to be angry, you know, and frustrated if they can't play the game that they've just purchased. So, you know, Launch Week, this is when the people who are really into the game start playing the game. Everybody wants to be playing on Launch Week. We've got a guy at work who actually takes days off work when games are released, you know, to be there 24/7 actually playing that game during Launch Week. After that, the demand is going to actually back off, and they're going to be at this scenario, you know, 2 or 3 years later, when there's a few sort of hardcore diehard fans who are still playing, you know, that particular version of Halo because they love it and because their friends play it. But, you know, most people have moved on to something else. So there's a real challenge here for people who are producing and delivering these games. It needs to work on day one. But they can't afford to actually, you know, build physical capacity for this. You don't want to buy this infrastructure that gives you this this type of a capacity. Firstly, because you don't know what the capacity is going to be. Secondly, you know, what do you do a week after Launch Week with all the capacity that you've invested on? So I think that the you know, cloud platforms like Windows Azure are ideal for this type of scenario. You can basically go in and say, okay, we want you know, 100 servers. We want to be using this much capacity. We want, you know, this much actual infrastructure to be able to power our services. And then you launch the game, and you know, if you've under-provisioned, you can very easily you know, scale and increase the provisioning. And if you've over-provisioned, you know, it's not a problem. You can just say, okay, I don't need 100 instances, I need 80 instances on that platform. You can just basically reduce the number, and then gradually reduce the number as you actually are going through. When people talk about scalability, it's always increasing capacity. You scale up or you scale out and you add capacity to handle an increasing load. This is scalability, but it's in the other direction. You're going to be provisioning an infrastructure and you're going to be scaling down. So how is Halo using Windows Azure or Microsoft Azure, and how is it using Xbox Live? Well, Xbox Live provides a lot of core services. It provides membership, leaderboards, achievements, downloadable content, and all this type of stuff. But what they wanted to do with Halo 4 is to increase the experience for gamers. So as well as shipping the game on the Xbox, they've also got this app that you can download to Windows Phone and Windows 8, which is the Halo Waypoint. And Halo Waypoint is going to be integrated with services running in Windows Azure to be able to display game stats. Is anybody working with a Windows Azure Service Bus or played around with a Service Bus at all? Service Bus has the concept of message correlation and message sessions. So when you're playing a multiplayer game in Halo, you're placing messages on the Service Bus. And each of those messages will have a gamer ID on it. So all of the people who are playing in the specific game instance, this will be a globally unique identifier. The back-end services can correlate those messages together. And from all around the world or from all around from Europe, they can just basically gather together the four specific people who are playing in that multiplayer game, aggregate their messages together and get the actual scores out to Halo Waypoint very, very quickly. They also use it for game statistics, for game presence, showing where you are in the game, and also cheating and banning. They send in loads of telemetry data from how people are playing the online games into Azure. And then they've got a service called Stream Insight, which is Complex Event Processing Service, which basically monitors what's happening in the game. And if you go into, I'm not suggesting you try this, but if you go into a Halo deathmatch and start being really abusive and lots of people leave, and then you go into another room and lots of people leave, and you basically by the way that other people react to you in the game, you can get automatically banned in the game, and it will monitor for cheating as well. And this is providing a better gamer experience for the people who are playing by the rules, and it's also saving a lot of resources in having to have people to actually monitor and ban people. They're doing auto banning and stuff like that, and getting that technology to work. And this is how the future is going to be for PC games, Xbox games, mobile games. You don't really play a game in isolation. You have the games connected to some kind of service. You play with other people. You compete with other people, and the devices only have a certain amount of power. So being able to leverage a cloud platform for the back end for a game is going to be something that you're going to be focusing on. And there's a lot of technologies in the Microsoft Azure platform that are great for being able to build these types of scenarios. So a couple of resources I really recommend checking out. This is on Channel 9. It was recorded quite a while ago. But this guy is Hoop Samoa, who works on the Halo 4 team. And this guy over here is Clemens Vasters. I think he was speaking here last year. He did a session on Microsoft at Middleware Strategy. I think it was in this room or somewhere fairly close. But Clemens is really the father of the Windows Azure Service Bus. He's been working on this since about 2006, 2007. And he's really heavily involved with what you can do with the Service Bus, what you can do with the Internet of Things, and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's a great video to look and see sort of how all of this stuff fits together and the challenges that they had when they were building this solution. Also on Hansel Minutes, this session here with Katie McCaffrey talking about Halo services in Azure. And what she was talking about was, when they were testing for launch week, they were actually breaking production instances of the Windows Azure Service Bus when they were running their test simulations for what was going to happen when Halo 4 was being launched. So then they were going to the Service Bus team and saying, you have to build this bigger, you have to build this faster. It's not able to handle what's going to happen when we release this game. So they worked very closely with Microsoft to ensure that the Service Bus would be able to actually handle the demand when Halo 4 was released. And that's really interesting to spend half an hour listening to that and, sort of listen to behind the scenes about what went on in that particular scenario. So another of my passions is Formula One. I'm not sort of part of the Lotus team. I was actually out at Redmond campus in Microsoft, and I went into the Microsoft shop, and Microsoft basically have a sponsorship deal between the Renault team. So you can see the Microsoft Dynamics logo. You can see the Avanade logo on here. When I was, you guys work for Avanade, so did you know anything about this project?
Yeah. The car, but for the rest, no.
The Formula One teams are very, very secretive about sort of what they do and the technology that they're using. When I was growing up, I was watching James Hunt and Niki Lauda in 1976, 77, and all the Formula One teams were sponsored by cigarette companies. Nowadays, it's a really high-tech industry. Most of the Formula One teams will have a technology sponsor. And it's not just about having the Microsoft logo on the car. It's not just about the advertising. It's about the partnership between a technology company and a racing team as to how we can actually benefit from the racing team's technology to be able to actually help them to win races. And this advert's been playing on UK TV, sort of relating to how Microsoft is working with the Formula the Lotus team.
It's more than the driver. It's more than the car. For Lotus F1 team, the winning edge starts with the cloud, powered by Microsoft Dynamics, Azure, and Office 365. The team can analyze and share data from over 200 sensors, working in sync to make the calls that make the difference between winning and losing. This is the Microsoft Cloud.
I'm thinking about it. Formula One is a great industry for being able to look at how we can work with cloud computing. They've got budgets that other companies can only dream about. The amount of money that they're able to invest in these types of technologies. And you think about where they're running the races. They're all over the world, different weekends. The mission controls, where they actually sit and have their factories, are back in the UK. So they've got all of this communication network. The McLaren team used to have a sponsorship partnership with Vodafone specifically to handle the actual communications between the team and the actual factory. There's a lot of stuff going on technology wise in Formula One. And you think about the way they set up the cars. They're going to be running the Chinese Grand Prix on the weekend. They're going to be running practice on Friday. So they're going to be generating several terabytes of data tomorrow from all of the Formula One cars. They've got to actually set up on Saturday before Saturday lunchtime. They've got to set up the cars for qualifying, and they've got to take this several terabytes of data that they get during the practice sessions on Friday, and they've got to crunch it using very sophisticated algorithms to figure out what's the best way to set up the car. Millions of dollars is dependent on this. I heard a figure that a point in Formula One is worth $1 million in prize money, and a point can be decided. I think it was 0.5 seconds between Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton at the actual end of the last Grand Prix, and also the other cars sort of behind them. It was fractions of a second between many of the cars crossing the line, and a lot of points, millions of dollars in that time. So, cloud computing allows you to spin up 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 servers, use them for 24 hours, and then just unprovision those servers. So the ideal scenario for cloud computing is having this, terabytes of data that we need to churn in a short space of time. We need massive capacity to be able to do this. And, we're located in China or Bahrain or, Singapore or somewhere like that. How do you actually go about building that infrastructure? The cloud is very useful in those types of scenarios. So what the Formula One cars have in them is this thing. This is an engine control unit, or an ECU. These were developed several years ago by McLaren Electronics in partnership with Microsoft, and that's the actual official supplier. So every Formula One car has the same actual standard edition engine control unit in it from Microsoft Electronics. And Microsoft is also working with building the telemetry systems. The Atlas telemetry system is basically based on Microsoft technology. You don't normally see this telemetry data unless Lewis Hamilton basically tweeted this to basically show sort of how his car was differing with Jenson Button. But this is the types of data that they're actually using, and the ECU is going to be sending the telemetry data back to the actual track. Now, if you follow Formula One, you'll know about what happened in one of the early Grand Prix with Daniel Ricciardo, where there was telemetry data that was coming from his car. The fuel sensor was basically saying that he was consuming too much fuel. The team disagreed and said it was a faulty fuel sensor. So it's based on telemetry data that he was actually disqualified from the race. So this stuff is important. It's used for analysing the performance. It's used by the FIA to check what happens when for driver penalties, accidents, and all type of stuff. And the Formula One industry is really leading the world with how telemetry works. As we'll see later on, this is stuff that you can do on your regular car. You can basically go out and buy a Raspberry Pi and connect your car up to the cloud and basically harvest off telemetry data on your car. And many companies are going to be using this technology. We'll talk about this a bit later on. So as I mentioned, yeah, that partnership isn't just about having a logo on the car. There's a technology partnership going on behind the scenes there. Another thing that I think is going to be a massive driver in technology is the Internet of Things. And this is something that you can't have failed to have heard about. It's something that is going to be, I think it's going to be massive. It's going to be, probably bigger than cloud computing, more diverse than cloud computing. There are some fantastic opportunities for you if you want to go out and start exploring these. These are a couple of news stories that have come out this year. Coca-Cola have stockpiled 16 million network IDs. And they haven't said why they've stockpiled 16 million network IDs, but people have talked about it. Basically, if a device has a network card in it, that network card has a unique network identifier in it. So why do Coca-Cola need 16 million network IDs? Well, the analysts have been looking at this and says, well, what Coca-Cola are probably planning on doing is putting in network cards and network enabling all of their service, their soda dispensers in all of their restaurants all around the world. And that would make sense. Look at the actual amount of people that are using Wi-Fi, the amount of scenarios where these things can connect to the internet. We've also got the capacity with the various cloud platforms to be able to actually harvest and store and process this data. Azure storage allows you to store billions of rows of telemetry data in a storage table, and it costs you dollars per month to be able to actually store that data. It's not expensive to do this. And this is going to be a real economy boost for Coca-Cola because they need to send out their service engineers to check and service these machines. However, if they can figure out, in this bank of machines, maybe this one is getting, twice as much use as this one because this one's closer to the counter, they're going to be able to figure out exactly which machine needs to be serviced. The machines are going to be able to actually send up notification messages and saying, I need servicing, or, I've basically processed so many drinks, I need a new pump fitting, I need cleaning. They're going to be able to send commands to put that service, that actual machine offline and use this machine instead, and basically have control over those actual soda machines. And that's what can be done on a large scale. Google also have just spent $3.2 billion on a company that makes thermostats that are internet enabled. And this is a technology that's coming out from various companies that you can, internet-enable your house. You can have control over devices within your house going through the Internet of Things. These things are starting to become smart and starting to become internet-enabled. So the Internet of Things, there's going to be so many different devices that are going to be connected to the Internet. We've got a project at work where we're working with Raspberry Pis as a learning exercise, a learning project. And I thought that was cool. I got a Raspberry Pi. It's is it 25 euros or something that they cost? Something around that. And I kind of thought that was a small computer. A friend of mine showed me the latest thing that was coming out from, I don't have a picture of it, but it was out from Intel. And it was an actual computer on a board the size of a SIM card. And what the actual project they were focusing on was a baby monitor. You can basically connect this computer on a baby, and it will monitor the breathing and the heart rate and send that telemetry data over a Bluetooth network. Very, very low power consumption. And they could seal it in something that was waterproof. But the actual device was probably about that big that can actually fit on the actual baby. So many scenarios where the Internet of Things are going to be useful. Your fridge, air conditioning, heating, weather systems, cars, soda machines, information boards that we've got at the airports and the train stations and so on are all going to be connected. And they need to be connected to something. And cloud-based services is a perfect scenario for being able to make that connection. A scenario where this is going to be useful, what happened in California and in other places in the US is when it gets hot, everybody goes and turns on their air conditioning. And what started happening is that the amount of energy that the grid can supply is limited. It's a finite amount. So if everybody turns on their air conditioning, the power basically goes out in these regions. This happened in Sweden. I live in Stockholm, and we had a winter in Stockholm where we suddenly got this cold snap where it was minus 20 degrees. My wife's relatives, they live in a very well-to-do area of town where all of the big houses are. And the latest trend in that area of town was to get these heat exchange systems. So they basically rip out the heating systems that run on gas or run on oil, and they put in an electric heat exchange system. They drill a really deep hole into the ground. They basically put in this heat exchange, and they have this heat pump that's powered by electricity. So all of these big houses were basically spending loads and loads of money on building these heating systems that were going to be, you know, environmentally friendly and be able to actually power their heating. Yeah, that's okay. Everybody's investing in those heating things. But then they got this cold snap where it's minus 20 degrees. So everybody went in and, you know, turned up their heating systems, and the power went out in the entire area. Nobody had electricity. Nobody had heating. And they put the power back on. Everybody cranked up the heating systems. They had all these problems with the power because of that. So now what's the trend for these well-to-do people buying? What are they all investing in now? Well, it's plug-in hybrid cars. And that just makes the problem even worse, because they drive home in their plug-in hybrid car, they plug in their hybrid car, they go inside, they turn on the heating, turn on the oven, turn on the lights, turn on the TV, put something in the microwave, and the power is just going to go out into the whole area. So one of the things that the Internet of Things is looking at solving is particularly these types of problems. If you've got the heating system internet-enabled, if you've got the charger for your car internet-enabled, then the power companies can have some control and some influence over when you use your electricity. It would be much better to turn everybody's heating down 10% in the entire area than the entire area goes without electricity. It would be much better when you come home and you plug in your plug-in hybrid car. If you're not going to use that car until 7 o'clock the next morning, you can basically just plug it in and just basically allow the electricity company to choose a time when that car is going to charge based on the electricity price. And they could offer you an incentive. You could press a button and say charge it now, or you could have an off-rate charge, and it will basically charge up your car for, you know, 60% of the price of doing a regular charge. But you need to have some kind of connectivity there. You need to have these devices, you know, synchronized to the internet. And that's a great scenario where I see the Internet of Things is going to help to, you know, make these things happen. So this is what we're doing at work. This is what we do on Wednesday afternoon. We basically have this learning by doing session. And what this is a Raspberry Pi in the actual bottom of the board. And there's another board on top of this, which is called a Pi Brick. And that interfaces with the Raspberry Pi and allows us to connect these things, which are Lego Mindstorms components. We've got a motor there, and we've got a couple of sensors. This thing here is a wireless network card that basically plugs into the USB drive, and you hook that up to a battery and basically put some code on there. And this can interface using the HTTP protocol with the Windows Azure storage services, or it can use the AMQP protocol and integrate with the Windows Azure service bus to be able to send data. And, you know, my sort of real interest here is looking at the telemetry data that we get from the sensors and be able to send that telemetry data into Windows Azure and then be able to actually process that telemetry data with a cloud-based application. This is our coffee machine at work, another of these actual projects. So these coffee machines are actually on weighing scales. The weighing scales have an interface with another Raspberry Pi, which is this thing in a box, which is connected onto the actual network. So one of the guys at work who's built this, he basically sits on his desk, and he's got these actual graphs that show, you know, how much coffee there is in the coffee machine. And he can tell, you know, when it gets to a certain level, somebody's got to go and actually fill the coffee machine, and it will go back up again. And it's quite intelligent about, you know, obviously when you're taking off the coffee and putting on the coffee, it will actually detect and only send these actual telemetry messages when it needs to. And this is running against the Windows Azure service bus. So wherever he is, he can go in his phone and check the actual levels of the coffee machines at work and so on. Now, that's kind of you know, a fun project, but think about it. If you are a company that is manufacturing coffee machines, just like Coca-Cola, if you can basically get telemetry data from your coffee machines, you're going to know when they need servicing. You're going to know when they need new components. You're going to know, you know, who are your best customers, who's using them. You know, who could you recommend has an advanced coffee machine or a more coffee machine with more capacity because they're using so many cups of coffee a day and so on. Is it going to be more economical for somebody to have a smaller coffee machine because they're not using it that much? All of those usage statistics are going to be very useful data to have. Another resource I recommend checking out is this. Clemens Vasters has done a series on device to cloud. And this is part 7 in that 8-part series. So what he's done, he actually starts this webcast driving at about 102 many kilometres an hour along an autobahn in Germany in his Audi. And he's got the actual, there's a connection on the Audi which can buy an interface, and that goes into a USB port. And he's got the Raspberry Pi running, and that's connected to the actual Wi-Fi in his car. And that's sending information onto the Windows Azure Service Bus. So he can drive around, and when he gets home, he can go into Excel, connect that onto a storage table in Azure, and basically see graphs of what his engine temperature is, what his speed is, and various information about what's going on there with his actual driving. Now, that can be done with a Raspberry Pi. Raspberry Pis cost €25. Think what you could do for a taxi company. Think what you could do for a van delivery company that wants to have tracking on its vans. It wants to know when its vans need servicing. It wants to know in real time where its vans are. It wants to go back over last month, look at all of the actual delivery patterns for its vans and say, were we making the most intelligent use of our resources based on this actual telemetry data? I heard of one scenario where it was a taxi company and they were recording this telemetry data, and they had a system with an actual PC in the taxi, and they had a USB plug-in removable hard drive that was storing the telemetry data on it. Every day, when the taxis come in, they had to actually take the USB hard drive and give it to somebody. They got 500 hard drives per day coming in with this telemetry data that somebody was plugging into a machine and copying onto another server, and then they were going through and processing. It was not real time. It was expensive. It was very cumbersome. It was very resource intensive. And, a Raspberry Pi is much cheaper than a removable hard drive. It's a no-brainer that, this is going to be a really useful technology. And we've got a guy at work who's doing the same thing with his motorbike. He's actually putting telemetry data on from his motorbike and getting that sent into Azure using the same sensor and so on. It's cool stuff. You can do this as a hobby, and definitely as a company, these is going to be great opportunities. Not many people are doing this. This is a time to start looking into this these scenarios and seeing how you can make this work. So when you're working with the Internet of Things and device connectivity, there's various ways that you can exchange information with the cloud. I've been talking a lot about telemetry. Telemetry is just basically sending data in a one-way path, sending a stream of messages or sending event messages when something happens into the cloud. So we've talked about driver telemetry. You can have coffee machine telemetry, heating telemetry. It's just a stream of data, stuff that you can harvest and process. You've also got inquiries. Your heating system or your air conditioning system may send out an inquiry. What is the electricity price now? What is the demand for electricity? What's the weather forecast going to be, and so on? And be able to actually, base whether we need to actually turn on the air conditioning based on how cold it is going to be in the evening, based on the weather forecast as well. Commands, this is obvious. If your friends invite you out for a beer to go and watch the football game after work, you may want to say, okay, well, don't turn the heating on, don't turn the air conditioning on, because I'm going to be home very late. You also may want to have the power company sending commands to these systems. Dial down everybody 10% so we don't actually blow a fuse in the actual region and put everybody's power out. Notifications, update the actual software. It could be, various messages are coming out about, this machine needs servicing, shut down this machine, and so on. You've got that option to send sort of one-way communication messages and so on. So a bit onto the project that I'm working on. I'm basically, really into doing stuff with Windows Azure. I deliver a lot of training courses. And I was, as I mentioned in my previous session, I was a physics geek at school, top of the class in physics. And I kind of love this type of stuff, the mechanics, force equals mass times acceleration, S equals UT plus half A, S equals UT plus half AT squared, all that type of formulas. I was kind of just naturally good at working out those types of equations. And I find it interesting, and it's fun to play around with those also in computer simulations. I'm an avid Formula One fan, as you may have gathered, and I also like playing racing games. I'm playing Forza Horizon a lot. That's kind of the type of a game I like. I'm not really into the simulations that much. I kind of like having a bit of an arcade feel to the game. So Red Dog Racing is the XNA game, which started out as XNA Racer. As you can see, I've modified it. I've reskinned the cars. I've modded all of the tracks. I've rewritten the physics engine. I've added a KERS and DRS systems to it. So it's kind of a bit like Formula One. There's a bit of strategy in there. It's also got the integration with Microsoft Azure. The reason I did this was I was building a Pluralsight course on Azure storage, and I wanted to have a demo that would be fun, that would be different, that would show off some of the capabilities that we've got in Azure storage, and also send a stream of data to the queues rather than just sending individual messages there. So that's basically what I've focused on doing there. I use it in my sort of demos, training courses, and workshops and stuff like that as an Azure case study. So when you're building an application and considering using the Azure platform, there's a number of things that you need to be aware of, sort of relating to how Windows Azure works and so on. I kind of think that Windows Azure is very similar to .NET. I learned .NET in 2001, in the early days of .NET. And if you'd started learning .NET then, like me, there wasn't that much to learn. You'd basically learn about ASP.NET, and then you'd learn about .NET remoting and ASMX services, and a bit about the data access code, and a bit about building Windows applications, and that was it. That was .NET. And I took the .NET exams. You did sort of four exams, three technology exams, and an architect exam, and you knew .NET. Now things have changed. The .NET platform is everywhere, and it's impossible now to even consider learning all of the .NET technologies. There's just too much stuff to learn. So you end up specializing. You end up saying, am I going to work on Windows Presentation Foundation, or am I going to work on Communication Foundation, or am I going to focus on data access and those types of technologies? And piecing together these various technologies to build a solution. It's exactly the same with Microsoft Azure. When Microsoft announced Windows Azure, I don't know if you're aware of this branding change, but it used to be called Windows Azure, and now it's called Microsoft Azure. So everybody's got to rebrand everything that they've ever done related to Azure. And I keep saying Windows Azure too many times in my presentation. I've heard that everybody else is doing, but Microsoft Azure is the official name for it now. So when they released the first announcement of these technologies, there wasn't much. There was web roles, there was worker roles, there was a service bus, there was these various storage services. And since then, it has evolved into a huge platform with all kinds of stuff. So, this isn't really a complete list. This is probably maybe about half of the Microsoft Azure services that we've got to work with. We've got networking, content delivery network, we've got media services, caching, messaging in the service bus, all of the identity stuff. And when you're building an application using these technologies, the thing you really want to do is to figure out which of these services am I going to build my application on. So, when it comes to data storage, am I going to use table storage, or am I going to use Windows Azure SQL Database, or Microsoft Azure SQL Database as it's called now? Or am I going to use blob storage? When it comes to queuing technologies, am I going to use a service bus, or am I going to use a queues in storage? With data storage and data processing, am I going to use HD Insight and those technologies there? Or am I going to spin up a VM and use SQL Server reporting services? What's going to give me the best way of being able to process these datas? Am I going to use caching? Where am I going to use caching? What am I going to cache, and so on? So understanding a bit about all of these services is useful, and then having a deeper knowledge of the services that you're actually going to be using is going to be useful as well. So what I've done is I've basically thought about those Internet of Things and message exchange patterns when I was considering building the implementation of Red Dog Racing. So what I've got is telemetry. I'm basically taking, this is kind of a no-brainer for a driving game. The telemetry data is, stuff about what's going on with the car. So we've got the driver, we've got the lap data, which is the driver details, the sector times, and the lap times. That's all used in the scoring, who's set the fastest lap and so on, doing lap time comparisons. We've also got the telemetry data, which is the car position, the driver input, and various parameters that we're taking out of the physics engine for the game. And we're sending that into the cloud using storage queues. We've got inquiries. When you start the game is going to want to actually display who's set the best lap time. So when the game starts, it makes a call to a REST service that will basically return the best lap times from the Azure storage. They're basically stored in the cloud. And then they basically come back into the game, and the game can actually display the lap times down here and say what position you've got as you pass the various sectors. So that's the inquiries pattern. Commands. I kind of had a hard time with this, figuring out how the actual game engine or the actual back-end services was going to be sending actual commands to the game engine. But I have built something in, which I will hopefully have time to demo during this session, which is to punish drivers for breaking the rules. And I'll talk a bit about how that works going on. I mean, if you've watched Formula One, you understand about race control and you know what happens when somebody does something. The race control will basically analyse it, and drivers will get punishments for breaking the rules. And I've put the same type of thing into the game, and I'll hopefully show you how that is going to work. Notifications. I'm using the service bus to send notifications to the game when players set lap times. So as people are driving around the lap, you've got many people playing the game. They're all connected to Azure. And you basically want to have some kind of notification popping up that says, you know, so-and-so has completed a lap. So you know that your friend has beaten your particular lap time. So I'm using the notification services as well to also. And this also sends messages from race control. So you will see that you are under investigation if you break the rules in the game, and you will get punishments that are sent by these notification messages as well. So this is what my architecture looks like in Microsoft Azure. Starting at this end here, I've got the racing game, which is basically sending data into the service bus. And I'm using queues and topics in the service bus. I've also got a switch in the game, so I can use storage queues if I want to. I can switch on to storage queues. So the data is being sent onto a topic, and we've got various subscriptions. So I can have multiple applications that are subscribing to that telemetry data or to that lap data or to that actual car position data. We have a worker role in Windows Azure, and that worker role is basically hosting a service that is dequeuing the data that's coming in from the service bus subscriptions, processing that data, making a few basic decisions on that data, then also storing that data in table storage. So we've got you know, data being inserted into the tables right here. Another service I'm using in the storage services is the blob storage, and I'm using that for driver replays. So when you basically drive around a lap and complete a lap, you'll basically set a lap time, but all of your actual position data will be sent as an actual blob of binary data into a blob container, which will be stored for the actual driver replays. So that's basically how I'm leveraging blob storage there. And then to actually display the information to users, I'm using a Windows Azure website, which is taking the data that we've got in the storage tables and presenting that using a web-based interface. So that allows you to basically see what's going on during the game. Now, scalability is going to be an issue. What happens if more people start playing the game? So if more people start playing the game, I've got a scalability target. This is kind of a single point of failure or a single point of scalability. I think you can take 2,000 message operations per second on the actual service bus, and we're sending the telemetry data once a second. So maybe around about 2,000 players, I've got to start thinking about changing this infrastructure here. The worker role, if that's dequeuing the messages and processing them, I can easily scale up the worker role tier and increase the number of worker roles to increase the number of messages. I can build functionality that will dynamically scale the number of worker roles that we're using based on the number of messages that we've got on those various subscriptions. So I can build in dynamic scalability if I want to. Storage pretty much scales itself within certain restrictions. I can run 20,000 transactions per second against a Windows Azure storage account. So there's lots of room for you know, scalability in there. I can store 200 terabytes of data in a Windows Azure storage account. So I've got a lot of you know, ways to be able to use storage. And I can scale out to multiple storage accounts if I do need that scalability. The web tier is also scalable. I can you know, scale out the actual website capacity, increase the capacity of the actual virtual machines if I want to do that. And then, you know, maybe I can think about including caching as well if we're getting a real serious load on the actual website there. So the website is basically going to be displaying things like the overall standings, the number of points, the lap times, and going in and showing all of the various bits of data like that. Now, what I want you to think about when we're thinking about that scenario is just take the game out of the scenario and think about this as maybe an architecture that you could be using for telemetry processing. It doesn't have to be a driving game. One of the real points that I'm making here is, yes, it's fun to you know, play around with telemetry data in driving games. However, it could be a soda machine. It could be you know, a fleet of taxis or delivery vans. It could be a game on a mobile application. It could be a heating or cooling system or a coffee machine. This kind of architecture and building this stuff on the Azure platform is going to be able to handle that telemetry data. You've got the whole other world of, you know, dealing with the Internet of Things. How can telemetry data send messages and actually get messages onto the storage queues? And Clemens provides a really detailed coverage of that and his Internet of Things scenario. So what I'm really focusing on here is, you know, how can you take that telemetry data, process it, you know, do useful stuff with it and display the results for a user. You know, if we got an Internet of Things project at work, we'd, you know, start off considering this type of architecture to think about how we could, you know, go about processing those particular scenarios. And then have somebody, you know, going in, you know, using the website, monitoring that data. So first thing I'll cover is how the lap time and how the actual data storing works. You know, it's really important that when we're working with a gaming scenario, we're going to have some form of competition. You're going to be competing. We're going to be actually recording the scores. So as the drivers set laps and start driving around and setting sector data, we're going to be placing messages on the service bus queue. The worker roles are going to be processing that data and putting that into a storage table, which is the lap times table, and the data is going to be appearing on the website. So I can basically show you how that works. What happens is the game itself has basically, as I mentioned, it's the XNA, but it's been modified to actually send the data into storage. So I've got an actual class in here, which is the Azure Data class. And if I go into the tables, we've got a lapse data table here. Now, what I do is I kind of run different events. So there's two different tables here. There is a player lap time table, and there's also a ranking lap time table. The player lap time table will store all of the data for all of the laps, and I have one table for each track that we've got in the game. And then when we're running events, so if I run a user group event, or if I run an actual course, or if I run a workshop, then I can basically have an actual table for that particular workshop, which is where the actual scoring will come in. Now, I could just run it for just have it continuously, but if somebody sets a really fast lap time, it's going to be really hard to beat. So you kind of want to reset the scores with each event you're doing. So I'm basically hard coding an actual table name in there to get that to work. And I'm basically working here with the Azure Storage APIs. You can see that I'm using Microsoft.WindowsAzure.Storage, the author, and the table, and so on. I'm basically saving data. I've got a method here to insert a ranked lap time, insert or replace the actual driver data. Now, when you're working with table storage, one of the things I'm doing here is I'm using things that are called dynamic table entities. Now, the reason that I'm doing that is if we go into the actual tables and look at this, this is the Tech Days NL table here, and you can see the actual data that we've got in there. Now, this, we've got the partition key, the row key, the timestamp, we've got the player name, and then we've got, you know, the amount of damage, the number of crashes. But the important thing that we've got here is the actual lap time that's coming in milliseconds. Now, there's three different tracks in the game. The tracks are of different lengths, track 0, track 1, and track 2. And the tracks basically have a sector, which is going to be occurring every 500 metres. Now, if the tracks are different lengths, then we're going to get different numbers of sectors in each actual lap. So you can see that we run up to sector 8 for the first lap. We run up to sector 13 for the middle lap. And the other lap, the longest lap, runs up to sector 23. So it must be about sort of 12 kilometres long, something like that, in the actual game world. Now, when you think about working with table storage, do not think about rows and do not think about columns. Think about entities and properties. So this is really, really hard to do, especially if, like me, I've been working with a relational database system for a long period of time. Switching over to this non-relational entity storage is challenging. The way that this data is displayed, it does look like that there is a column with the name of Sector 21, and that these actual entities or these rows have a null value or an empty value for that Sector 21. It's not that. That's not the case at all. These are entities, and the entities have properties, and it's just the way that this tool displays the contents of the table that means that these kind of properties are all lined up with the actual all of the properties, and they're basically put into columns. They're entities and properties, and you can put whatever properties you like on an entity. You can add, I think there's 256, so you can add about 253 entities, properties to an entity. But you have to have a partition key and a row key here. So this data is written by the driving game, and it's used in the actual lap tables. If we go into Red Dog Racing and go into the beginner table, You can see here that we've got Matthias and Alan, who's basically setting them. And they basically appear in the order with Matthias and Alan. And if you go into the advanced, I won on that particular lap, and go into the expert, you can see the actual times there. Now, when you're querying table storage, you've got to do it in certain ways. If you've been working with SQL Server for a long time, you're so used to doing things like, this is dead easy. I just do, select the position and select the name and the time and the actual damage from the lapse table, and then you specify order by lap time. However, when you're working with Azure Table Storage, you cannot specify order by. You will basically get the top of the table based on your actual query. So what you can do when you're querying table storage is select the actual partition key. You can see here it's kind of dimmed out, but it says partition key EQ. So what I can do is I can do a query where the partition key and then I can specify track 1. So what I'm doing here is I'm querying on a specific partition. Now, what happens here is this is a very efficient query. I could, if I want to, query on the actual car type, where car type is equal to 1, or where damage is less than 200 or something like that. However, that would not be an efficient query. It's very efficient to query by the partition key and also by the actual row key. Now, data that you will get in your query will be sorted in order of the row key. This is a string value, and it's in alphabetical order of the row key. So if I want the top lapse to appear at the top of my query, because you do have the option to, say, run a query and say take 10 or take 20, but you can't do the order by clause in the actual query itself. You have to order client side. So what I want to do, what I need to do, is I need to ensure that the row key is in order of the actual lap time. So the lap with the fastest lap time is going to be this here, and then this is going to be second, and this is going to be third. Now, there's a way to do this. You can see lap time in milliseconds. If you're a bit further towards the back, this says 113688. And the actual row key starts with 00113668. So what I'm doing is I'm zero padding. I'm taking the lap time in milliseconds, zero padding it, and sticking it in the actual row key. I'm also putting a timestamp in there. So if two people get exactly the same lap time, I don't actually overwrite the actual data itself there. So when you're working with table storage, this decision, what do I use for my partition key, what do I use for my row key, is going to be very important. It's going to govern how you can query the data and how you can store the data. Queries will be efficient with a very small amount of entities. So querying by car type will work, but it will not work when you get a million entities in the table. I've done tests with a billion entities in the table, and querying by partition key took about 200 milliseconds or 150 milliseconds. Querying by another property just basically timed out after like 20 minutes. It just wasn't going to receive that data. It's going to be very, very inefficient. So we do need to focus on these guys. So there are some limitations in using Windows Azure Table Storage. I really wanted to use Azure Table Storage in this scenario, rather than just take the easy route and use a SQL database, because I wanted scalability. I've tested this. You could store data for a billion laps in this table, and it still would work. So if you've got an online game with a million players or a billion players, it is going to actually support that type of scalability for these people actually playing the game. So looking at the next storage service that we're using, how the actual telemetry data is processed. The lap data, we don't store that much of it. We're basically sending a message every time you complete a sector, and you roughly complete a sector every 10 seconds. So it's one message every 10 seconds. Telemetry data, what we really want to do here is to produce a graph of the actual how the player is playing the game. And when I was kind of thinking here, I was saying, how often should we send the telemetry data? Now, once a second is quite often for actually sending messages on the service bus. However, If you think about what's happening playing a racing game and you're driving around a corner, if you're sending the position data once a second, it's not going to be accurate enough to actually plot and basically understand how the car drove around the lap. So I sample the telemetry data 10 times a second and I send the message once a second. And then it's basically a dequeuing and inserting. So we get 10 rows of telemetry data for every second's gameplay. And that's generating a lot of data. So you drive a lap and it can generate 1,000 or 2,000 rows of telemetry data just for one person driving around a lap in the game. So thousands of laps is going to be millions of rows of telemetry data. Millions of laps is going to be billions of rows of telemetry data. And storing the telemetry data, we can go and see how that is stored. If I go in here and look at the telemetry data zero and a query on that, I'll take away this query here and run that. That should bring back entities from the telemetry data. Now, here I'm using the actual lap ID. Every game in the game has a lap ID, and it's a GUID, and the lap ID is basically the partition key for the telemetry data. The reason there is I want to say select the telemetry data for this lap. So I'm querying the table saying, as I did previously, partition key is equal to that GUID, and that gets me the telemetry data for that lap. I also need to have a row key. The row key is the game time in milliseconds. I won't send two bits of telemetry data with the same game time in milliseconds. And even if I do, they're going to contain the same data, so they would could overwrite each other. So that's basically the stuff that I'm storing there. And what I'm doing is basically storing all of the various actual properties on these entities for the actual telemetry stuff that I want to store. So I'm storing brakes percent, throttle percent, the car's position, the acceleration, damage, downforce, drag, engine force, all of this type of stuff is going into this table. Now remember, these aren't rows and columns. So if I want to add a couple of bits of telemetry data to this, then I can just add them and store them in this table. As long as I don't go above the 253 properties I can add to my entities, I can just store this stuff. So I can chop and change this telemetry data. It's very flexible. I don't have to modify the table. I just have to modify the code that sends the entities and modify the code that's going to query the entities. So that's basically how the telemetry works. And I'll show you how it works in the website a bit later on. So the storage analysis of telemetry data, we're basically storing the stuff in storage tables. It's being processed by the worker role and it's visible on the website. I do a couple of things with telemetry data. I've got the website that basically allows you to go into your lap and see how you've driven that lap. So that's saying car speed there. We've got the actual car speed relative to the position of the lap. I've also, and this has been working on and off, it's currently off at the moment, but I've got a telemetry analysis application, which will read a large amount of telemetry data and basically draw out the car's position. It's quite hard to see, but there's areas where the colour is a bit darker. So the colour is indicating the speed on the track. You can see it's a bit darker around here. And these red dots are indicating crashes that have occurred. So this allows me to access the telemetry data for all given laps and be able to actually process it and do statistical analysis on it. So this would be really great for using these big data processing techniques. What's the optimal driving line around this particular corner? By looking at everybody who's driven around that corner, how they've driven around that corner, what they were doing with their brakes and their acceleration and their curves and their DRS and all this type of stuff, what actual line they were taking through that corner, and which is the quickest way to actually drive around that. So this would be really cool. If I didn't have to do work, I'd probably sit at home and build a driver AI that would be based on the telemetry data. And we'd actually use the telemetry data to actually run the driver AIs. So you get the ghost cars, but they would be based on particular drivers actually driving around the track. I know that I think the latest Forza game for the Xbox One is doing all kinds of clever stuff like that, being able to actually race against your friends even when your friends aren't online, because the driver AI will basically use the same techniques as your friends will do. So that's all kinds of clever stuff you can do with that. So looking at the actual website itself, we can go into the actual laps here, and this brings up the telemetry data. Now, telemetry data is relative to track position. It's not relative to the lap time, because you want to see the speed that you were going around a particular curve and the driver input around a particular curve. I need to mod this to actually show two lap times compared. You want to see your lap time compared with your friend's lap time or the best lap time, and see where you and your friend were using curves or using DRS and why certain people are driving faster than you and what kind of driver input they're providing. So I'm going to try and hopefully add that functionality there. Another thing that we've got is the storage of ghost cars. So when you complete a lap in the original X and A game, what would happen is it would basically save the ghost car as a binary file. And it would typically save it, if you were using the Windows desktop version, it would save it in the, sort of the local user store. If you're using the Xbox version, because you could compile and run this on the Xbox, it would store it in the Xbox storage. So all I did, and this is a very simple modification, I modified the code that was going to store the actual replay data to actually store that replay data in Azure Blob storage. And I can show you how I did that, I think, if I can locate that particular bit of code. So within the blobs, we've got this replay blob store, and I'll just see if I can find the... upload stream method has one method, and that's coming from replay.cs. So I just basically modified the original replay data. This is the original save method that doesn't have any references, and that was saving it to the actual storage systems. I just added this method at save to blob, so I'm using the actual storage API client library to actually upload the data to blob storage, and it's that much code that basically you know, the game is storing the data in blob storage. So if you go back to the actual blobs here, we can go and see the actual replays blob container, and you can't actually open these files. These are actually binary data, but you can see this is for the advanced track, and then you've got the LAP ID, and that's the actual replay data that we've got there. So when we start up the game will go out to the REST service. It queries the REST service and gets back the best lap times for that particular service. And I think I've got the limit set to something like 50 ghost cars on each track that it will display. Gets the best times, and then it goes to blob storage and downloads the actual replay data for these ghost cars. And then when you start driving the lap, you're actually racing against the ghost cars of other people who've actually played the game previously. And there's so many modifications I want to do this. It'd be really nice to have the driver's name on the ghost car so I see that I'm racing a certain person, because that information you've got in the actual driver tables, in the actual high scores tables as well, that you can use combined up with that. So... I think that's about all. Oh, yeah, I was also going to cover the in-game messaging. Now, I'm currently using the Relay Eventing Service for in-game messaging. I'm going to change this because this only supports up to about 20 connections. So if I'm running a racing game workshop and there's 16 people who are, you know, working through labs doing this, this is going to work fine. However, if we do it on any kind of larger scale, it's not going to work. So I really want to replace that with some kind of eventing system that will scale up to thousands of players, even tens of thousands of players possibly. But what this basically does is, as the lap time data is going in, the worker roles are processing and they're monitoring the actual lap data. I'm using message sessions, so we get a thread to process all the telemetry data coming from a specific lap. When the lap is complete, it will send out the actual data, and it will basically make a call to this endpoint. Now, the relay eventing service means that all of these basically expose a service or expose an endpoint, but instead of the endpoint being exposed here, the endpoint is exposed on the cloud. When we make a call to that endpoint, a single one-way operation, the call will be relayed to all of the listening actual applications. And we can have up to 20 listening applications. And that will mean that the lap time will come up on the screens of all the people who are actually playing the game. And that's kind of, you know, really nice to have that kind of a notification going on within the game. So I'll run through a demo and just show you how this stuff works and a bit about what's going on in the actual game. And then I'll sort of give you some further resources for actually working and continuing with the game. So... looking at the actual game, I'm going to actually spin up the back end. Now, I did say we had a worker role processing data and so on. We have actually got an application that's running. So I wanted to show sort of when the messages were coming in and how we were interacting with the messages. So if I start this application here, this is basically simulating the worker role on premise, so you can see the actual messages coming in and what's happening with the actual message sessions. So that's basically the message processing side of things. Now, this is a driver tracker. This is what you can, I mean, if you're watching the Formula One practice, you can actually log on to F1.com and you can download their driver tracker, which I think runs in Java. And that will basically run in your browser and it will show you the actual live position of everybody who's in the practice and in the race and so on. So the driver tracker technology is used by various people. You'll see everybody sat on the pit wall watching all of this stuff happening. And if you've got a TV company with sort of multi-channels who's showing the Formula One, you can usually go in and see the actual driver tracker live, so that's kind of what I've simulated. I get points from the telemetry data and basically plot out the tracks. So you can see the three tracks in the game world here that are appearing in that actual driver tracker. So let's start the actual racing game itself. And as I mentioned, when the racing game starts up, you'll see in the debug window it will get the high scores. Let's go into the output window. It's throwing a few exceptions, but we'll ignore that for a while. I'll turn off the sound as well, because that's going to be very annoying. As you can see here, that it basically... we get the high scores for the three tracks. It's saying they're getting high scores done for the various three tracks. And then we're actually loading the replay data. So as I started out, there's not that much data in the high scores table. There's only those few tracks. So here's where it's actually downloading those blobs that we can use for the actual ghost car replay data. So let's go in and set a lap. Let's have a look at the scores and see what I've got to beat. So Matthias basically beat my lap time on the beginner lap, so I'm going to see if I can take that back. And I'll drop the resolution a bit as well, so we can fit more stuff on the screen. So as I mentioned, I've made a lot of changes. You know, my company is called Active Solutions, so I skinned up an Active Solution car for the actual Christmas party. We were playing this at the Christmas party, and then I've got the Windows Azure car, which I spent a long time skinning, and I've now got to reskin it as Microsoft Azure to actually rebrand it, which is a bit of a pain. Oh, yeah, sorry, because it's going to be the red track. Good point there, yeah, so I'll drop that down there and hopefully we'll see that appearing there. So I've modified the tracks as well and basically put jumps in it. I did cover that in the physics session. I kind of liked to have the idea of cars jumping. You can see I'm using the curse system there, and I can use DRS now to get some extra speed, and then off I go off the jump. If I actually slowed, I'm going to slow down a bit and... let the car run past, because I think Matthias had the fastest lap, so he should see his ghost car overtake me. There it goes, so I'll start chasing that back. And that's coming from his driver positions from a previous lap that was uploaded. I'm not going to do this now. I've kind of killed it, I think. So, and it's quite impressive. I actually tested it, and with 200 ghost cars running on the same lap, it did work fine. I tried with 2,000 ghost cars, and it did start impacting on the frame rate. But you can get a lot of stuff going on in the actual game. I also have the ghost cars driving around the other two laps, so occasionally you'll see cars driving around the other two laps or jumping through loops as you're actually driving around the loop and so on. So I tried to put in a bit of fun stuff like that. I'm going to get nowhere near this time, but I won't bother with another lap here. You can see in the actual console, you can see all of the messages going past as they're being processed, coming off the service bus and going into table storage. And you can also see the actual live lap time, which is coming from the service bus into the actual driver tracker there. So I didn't manage to set a lap time. You can see it's saying that the actual session was complete. I'm using the sessions here, and I think that will be the lap ID that we're using, 55FCC. So if we go into the actual Azure storage, what we should hopefully see here, and I'll just exit the game like that, and go into the tables and into the take data now and run this query. You can see that we got a new lap time coming in there, hopefully for the beginner tracks. So there's Matthias and Alan, and you can see sort of all of the actual statistics relating to that. I did actually crash less than Matthias, so that's one good point there. So I think building these game services using Azure, it didn't take me long to do that. It took me a painfully long amount of time to do the actual work on the game, but to actually get the game running against Azure was incredibly productive. You saw how much code I had to write to actually get the blob uploaded into blob storage. The actual cost of storing this stuff and using this stuff, the billing for Azure storage, is incredibly cost effective. As I mentioned, you can store up to 200 terabytes of data in a storage account. I think the cost of storage is, I think it's something like $120 per terabyte per month or something. around that that measure. It's not expensive to store a lot of data in storage, and you look how small the actual blob storage are. If you do the maths and do the cost calculations and figure out how much it is going to cost per month to store the actual player data for a million players of your game, then it does come out very favourably. And especially if you look at how much money companies are making on these big games that are running, you've got the scalability there. The platform will scale within various limits to actually meet the demands. So you don't need to worry too much about scalability. You need to be aware of it. But stuff like the storage service does provide these 20,000 transactions a second on a storage account and massive data storage capabilities. Also, don't think it's just about games. This is about taxis and coffee machines and heating systems and industrial pumps and wind farms and all this type of stuff. Everything that in the near future is going to be connected to the internet is going to benefit from being able to build back-end systems using these technologies. There are some massive opportunities out there, so let's go out and take them and see what kind of great systems we can build. A bit about further resources. I did mention that I've built this as a sample for my Pluralsight course that I've done, so that does go into a lot more depth, and there's code samples of how I'm using Azure storage. I don't go into details on the service bus there, but I do cover how I'm using blobs, how I'm using tables, that kind of stuff. If you've got a Pluralsight account, you can check that out. If you don't have a Pluralsight account, I've got some 1 month free passes that you can check out. Also, the Chinese Grand Prix, which is going to start with the practice tomorrow, if you want to see all of this telemetry data in action, they will be mentioning this, and you'll see how they're using it. You'll see what kind of stuff goes on at a Formula One race when they do all this stuff, if you tune in. I'm not expecting you to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning tomorrow watching the actual practice, but it may be worth going in, seeing the race or the race highlights, just seeing the kind of stuff that the Formula teams are doing with this. Thanks very much for listening and being a part of this session. I always enjoy coming here to present, and please fill in the evaluations. Thank you very much.